Hello, welcome to Blurred Radio.
We're live.
We are live on Twitch TV and here in the studio in Long Beach, California. This is Dave Martina.
Jesse Springer.
And I don't know if you can see him, but we've got various other producer Michelle is here, and our new guy running the board, Joel, is here. And we're live on the phone, on the interphone, Skype, with Mr. Daryl Cagle. Political cartoonist extraordinaire. We're recording all this live, and this is we're actually having a blast already. This is our first time actually doing this completely live. So, welcome to the wonderful world of live
streaming. do we have a timeline playing good. Scrubbing, Joel? All right. Oh, lovely.
There Are we go. Good?
We're. Now I can. This is trial run. So I was saying, Jim Henson, you worked with for over a decade, right?
That was great. That was the start of my career with Muppet Graduate School.
That's incredible.
How did you get involved with the Muppets in the first place?
Well, I was a young illustrator. I went to New York to be an illustrator. And in those days, there was no Federal Express, no fax machines. And so all the ad agencies and all the magazines and all the publishers were in the same place, accessible by messenger.
And, all right.
You know, we had clubs. You could get together and see all the other illustrators and artists and writers and journalists and all in the same place. And that was really very exciting. And, you know, that doesn't exist anymore because,
right.
You know, everybody's all diffused across the country. And I miss that. That was really a cool time.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend used to think that I was quite important because I had messengers running to the door every few minutes, and they looked very important, but actually it was move Kermit's hand this way.
Right.
That way. So, the good old days.
Wonderful.
I'm imagining all the illustrators and reporters and ad people. You describe them as all being in one place, and I'm just imagining a zoo where we can go visit and see all of you hard at work in your cages 90 hours a week.
So you're working with Jim Henson, you're working with the Muppets, you're drawing characters, right? And creating toys too, right?
Most of what I was doing was putting pigs and frogs on product and Sesame Street and if you know the 80s, they were Muppet products everywhere.
The heyday.
The good old
so
days.
So how do you shift from that into cartoons and political cartoons and cartoons making a commentary on the world we live in?
Well, since I was designing Muppet cartoons, I was Muppet products. I got to know the product people at most of the toy companies, and I had designed products for most of the toy companies because just about everybody did a Muppet product. And so that kind of led to me being a toy inventor. And I worked as a toy inventor for about 5-6 years and did a bunch of toys for a bunch of toy companies. And that was great. I did a doll line for Hasbro with one of the Muppet artists. We designed this wonderful bunch of dolls and she made them all and it was so cool. And that's kind of a big score for a toy inventor. So I didn't have to work for a while. So I decided to do a comic, a traditional newspaper comic. And, you know, those don't pay anything, but you do them for love, and everybody wants to do a comic strip. So I did that. A newspaper that ran that in Hawaii called me up and said, "Hey, Daryl, how would you like to be the editorial cartoonist in Hawaii?" And I said, "Wow, editorial cartoonist in Hawaii. They just liked my cartoon that was running in their paper, and they called me up." And so I did. I was local cartoonist in Hawaii for about 5 years, and I ended up working for the Gannett Daily paper there. And I started world and national cartoons. And I didn't have a good experience doing my comic strip. You know, when you get cartoonists together, the first thing they like to do is complain about their syndicate sales. So I got a batch of cartoonists who, like me, all were disgusted with their syndicates. And we made a package of cartoons. This was back in 2000. And I hired a salesman. I'm the only cartoonist I have ever heard of who hired his own salesman. I hired a salesman to go out and sell our package to newspapers. And what was interesting about the year 2000 was that none of the other syndicates, none of the competing editorial cartoon services were delivering their cartoons by email yet or electronically at all. They were printing them out on paper and sending them by snail mail, so the newspapers all got them 3 days late. So,
website,
I sent them by email. We had a technological advantage for like 3 or 4 years. And I took advantage of that to get into most of the papers pretty quick. So I was in probably 500 papers in the first 4 or 5 years. This is a very stodgy business, and
right,
that kind of change doesn't happen very often. Mm. It's hard to think of another syndicate that started in the last 40 years. Right. So I kind of lucked out in my timing. And also, our service, which you can see at kegelcartoons.com, it's a newspaper package service.
Yeah.
It's got more content, better content, and cheaper content than all my competitors. So that's how I get them in the paper. It's my
motivation. Yep. Better, faster, cheaper. There we go. That's the recipe for success.
I want to get my cartoons in more papers than anybody else. So I use this as a kind of a vehicle to get me out there. And I kind of stand on the shoulders of all my great, talented buddies. It's sold as a batch. When I say I'm the most syndicated cartoonist in America, you can say that about anybody else in my package, because it's the package that they subscribe to rather than the individual cartoonist.
So this is actually interesting. I watched a documentary this week that is somewhat related. It's called Stripped. It's about how the comic strip industry has changed because people are buying less newspapers.
Yes.
And so you've started your own syndicate, and there's a lot of conversation in this documentary. If you're listening on Signal podcasting, by the way, swipe for a link to that documentary. there's a lot of conversation about syndicates, and I'm curious how you have seen, obviously, the fact that you could disseminate your information quicker than the national syndicates or the bigger corporations could was an advantage in the internet age. I'm curious, though, you keep saying you want to get into more newspapers, but aren't people buying less newspapers? What does the model actually look like in the world of the web?
Yeah.
Well, I think the big issue with newspapers is that they lost their big cash cows. With Craigslist, they lost the whole darn classified section.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was a driver for newspaper income. And they don't have help wanted ads anymore because those are on the internet. They just a huge amount of their income was taken away. You know, we like to talk about how young people are going to the internet and people are not looking at newspapers so much, but it's not that big a change in circulation as it is a change in they're losing their income. That's just a shock to the newspaper system. So what happens with me, with my cheap editorial cartoon service, the papers still want to have an editorial page, an editorial cartoon. That's a core part of the newspaper. And when they're cutting costs, they fire people rather than cut $20 a week for a little cartoon service. So we haven't been losing papers. We've been pretty pretty flat and pretty steady. And I think newspapers are going to stay, but they're going to have to survive on a much lower income level, and they're going to see continuing attrition in their circulation as their audience gets older. And you know, that's a big issue for them. They're upset about that. And it's you talk to them, it's always what they want to grouse about. How do we get the younger readers? One thing that's cool about editorial cartoons is that, and I thank George W. Bush for this. Part of No Child Left Behind, they're crazy about testing, and in 8th and 11th grade in state-mandated testing, in AP social studies testing, in every state in the country, they have editorial cartoons on the test. And
really?
So teachers teach to the test. The kids are required to take the test. So as some newspaper income has declined, our income from these testing services, licensing cartoons for the tests, has increased. And for the textbooks that put cartoons in the textbooks because they're teaching to the test, has increased. And we have this kind of steady young audience of kids doing their homework. Number one email I get is, "Dear Mr. Cagle, please explain the cartoon to me, my paper."
Oh my gosh.
So that's nice, and I think I think in that respect, the editorial cartoon is one of the things that the newspaper likes because it skews a little younger in that regard. Although,
right,
as I look at my website stats, my audience does skew much older than the typical website audience. So I think part of that problem is just the fact that it's about politics, And, you right. know, if I was drawing cute kitties, I would probably get a bigger, better, younger audience. But, you know,
better is questionable, but bigger perhaps. We need more cat memes on the internet, that's for sure. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I know an editorial cartoonist who draws nothing but cats in her editorial cartoons. Maybe that's a business plan.
Yeah, I was going to suggest. Strategic. I'm actually kind of curious because I don't hear many people thank George W. Bush for No Child Left Behind. So that's a sentiment I don't hear often. But it is interesting to me that what's happening is you're actually turning on younger and younger students to the idea of an editorial cartoon. Because it occurred to me as I was looking through your work that editorial cartoons are a older, more established version of what most people would refer to as memes today, right? It's like a two-line quip with a powerful image, and it says everything there is to say about a topic.
It has no lines at all.
Right.
There we go.
Show it, don't tell it. Right. And so I'm kind of curious if how you feel about memes and this crazy rampant proliferation of are memes the new editorial cartoon, or is there not that I think editorial cartoons would go away, but do you recognize in these memes that get passed around some of what you do?
No, I don't like memes. I don't think editorial cartoonists like memes at all. Because we think of ourselves as columnists with pictures rather than words. And, you know, we feel like we can express ourselves as well or better than somebody who uses words with the images. And the images are more powerful and they hit you right away. You don't cut a column out and stick it on the fridge. Well, I'm always getting hit with people saying, well, why don't you do a caption contest? Why don't you take the words out of the balloon in your cartoon, let people put their own words in
right.
it? Why don't you post the cartoons up there with this special app we've got?
Let's make it interactive.
People put whatever message they want into your editorial cartoon. Can you imagine saying that to a columnist?
Right.
You call a columnist and say, hey, we want to make your columns so that people can make you say whatever they want.
Right.
And they can put whatever ideas they want out of your mouth. So the whole idea of being an editorial cartoonist is that we love being part of the public debate, and we want to hit people on the head with our ideas, and that's fun. Otherwise, I would do some other kind of art that pays better. I would do illustration. I mean, we do this out of love because you care about this stuff and care about the world. And so memes are just god awful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're commenting on society. It's almost like you are Banksy. You are our muse, except with a public face. And
one thing I regret, though, about what we do is that here in America, editorial cartoons are not taken nearly as seriously, aren't nearly as important as they are in the rest of the world. You think of the Charlie Hebdo guys and those huge memorial services in France. You would never see anything like that in America. And on the day that they were all marching in the streets there, Obama was having a party with the San Antonio Spurs and not mentioning anything about it.
Right.
You know, that is the nature of editorial cartooning in America. It's the editors want to see us do funny little jokes. The funny little jokes get reprinted much more than the serious opinions. It's always a frustration for us. But in the rest of the world, editorial cartoons are really important. And, I think you saw that in January. I see that all the time, and I have a web audience that leans much more to international than to U.S.
Just that makes sense.
this is the world's eye on what America thinks and how, you go to Egypt and they'll have like 25 newspapers in Cairo, and you'll see an editorial cartoon on the front page of just about every newspaper.
Yeah.
They just regard cartoons as much more important in their society than we do. And I would love to raise some appreciation of that in America, but frankly, it's nice to be appreciated abroad more than I'm appreciated here.
The irony. A prophet is never welcome in his home. So it's interesting that you mentioned Charlie. You know, there's some friends and I were talking recently about the you know, Prophet Muhammad fiasco, where everybody's horrified of the idea of, you know, we can't show his face. We can't. And of course, South Park, with Trey and Matt being the pioneers that they are, they said, you know, we don't care. We're gonna do it anyways. How do you balance the deciding what, you know, because society has its own level of comfortability with certain topics, and perhaps you want to comment on things that are it's a conversation society might not be ready to have just yet. Mm-hmm. How do you balance, you know, maybe your ideals being ahead of, like you mentioned, you have an audience that's bigger in other countries than here in the United States, and I think that speaks volumes. How do you communicate with the American audience in light of that?
Yeah, how do you bring your audience along with you?
Well, you know, I have a lot of limitations. Newspapers have a 1.5 wide by 1 tall hole that they and it's got to be rated PG. And
yeah,
they want to get the middle schoolers to see the newspaper. And when I talk to my cartoonist buddies in France, they think American cartoonists are all prudes. They make jokes about how I can't draw this and can't draw that. You can't draw nipples in your cartoon.
Right, right.
And, you know, it's true. I don't really have an editor. I'm the editor of my package. I send cartoons out, and I've got to compete against all the other cartoonists to try to get into each newspaper every day. You know, a newspaper is probably going to get a dozen cartoons from us and a dozen cartoons from another package every day, spread them out on a table and say, well, I like that one. Or maybe
I heard you use the phrase Yahtzee. What is that a phrase you came up with to refer to that, right? The influx.
Kind of a different subject. Well, we can do that.
Okay.
The problem that we have is that the editors have so many cartoons to choose from every day. We have to deal with the editor's sensibilities to try to get him to pick my cartoon.
Yeah.
You know, editors don't like strong opinions. Editors don't like to see nipples in the cartoons. There's a censorship of the marketplace that happens by the nature of the fact that we have editors picking our cartoons. I can draw something strong. I can draw something crazy and something offensive. But, you know, the flip side of that is it's good because you don't want a racist bastard cartoonist being successful and having his cartoons everywhere, but you don't want to censor him, and the marketplace takes care of that. So our marketplace is more prudish than the French marketplace, and that's a restriction on me. You know, I have to draw cartoons about what they're talking about on CNN or Fox News that day, because that's the only thing the editors are interested in. If I've got a pet project that I'm interested in, I can't draw about that because nobody's going to care. And it won't get reprinted. So there are lots of restrictions on what I can do. So you talk about Muhammad. Are the editors going to reject Muhammad? You know, it depends. I think there's a misconception that American editors don't allow you to do Muhammad, because the New York Times famously said, we don't have to print the Danish Muhammad cartoons because we can describe them in words.
Right.
There was that book out of Yale where they all about the Muhammad cartoons, but they didn't put the Muhammad cartoons in it because that was too offensive.
Oh, my word.
I think that kind of leads to this misconception that newspapers didn't print them. And in fact, they were everywhere. MSNBC.com that I was working for then printed them. We posted them. I think almost the majority of newspapers printed the Danish Muhammad cartoons. On January 8th, the day after the Charlie Hebdo guys were murdered, we got a Muhammad cartoon from one of our cartoonists, David Fitzsimmons, and draws for the Tucson Arizona Daily Star. And it was Muhammad, and he's in the clouds, and there's this guy underneath him with a bloody knife. He's shaking it like this, and Muhammad says, "You guys are nuts." Well, we had the phone ringing all day that day from editors calling in to say, are other editors printing this cartoon? Because, you know, they look for affirmation from other editors. But clearly, that was the cartoon that everybody wanted to print on that day. And that
right.
was probably our most widely reprinted cartoon of the year. And it was a Muhammad cartoon.
Hmm.
So you know, it's not about, it, you know, it's not like cartoonists want to draw Muhammad. And if you do a Muhammad cartoon today, it wouldn't get reprinted because it's what they wanted on January 8th. And it was that cartoon they wanted. They didn't want to print a Muhammad cartoon. They wanted to make that statement on that day.
Right.
And I haven't drawn Muhammad cartoons myself because I consider it like using the N-word or drawing something that's offensive to a particular group. Do I want to have the discussion of, well, oh, look, well, Daryl drew this and that's offensive and that's what it's all about and that overpowers whatever he's saying in that cartoon. So
right. It's
kind of the same story with something that's offensive to people in one group or another in one way or another. And you have to balance that against how important is the point you want to make, how important is being offensive to the point you want to make. There's some cartoonists who will you want to use four-letter words in their cartoons, and they insist they have to do that. And if they can't, then it's like they're being repressed by the press. And in fact, you know, it's probably good that they're stuck in with just the editors who are willing to accept that.
You know, you bring up this, there's obviously a difference between wanting to be inflammatory for the purposes of making a point about being inflammatory or about censorship versus, I think what you said very wisely about like wanting your message to be heard and understood and speaking the language that people can understand. And if all people see is red when they see your cartoon, they're not going to actually hear what you're saying. And this brings me to a question that I've had about cartoons before, which is that cartoons are, especially political cartoons, they're caricatures. They're drawn so as to visually accentuate certain prominent features. I'm wondering if how much of that carries over into the commentary and the discourse itself. How much is hyperbole used? How much is it? I mean, obviously it's used widely, but how much is too much? When does that caricaturing of issues start getting in the way of an actual discussion that needs to be had?
Well, there's a lot of talk now about where are the red lines, and everybody wants to define what's going too far. And what's going too far is goring my particular ox. And I think that things have changed now in that people are much more sensitive and angry, and they react to cartoons by that they disagree with by seeking retribution. In the old days, before the internet, people would write a letter to the editor, and it would be edited and fact-checked, and only a few of them would get into the paper, and it was kind of a nice collegial dialogue.
Right.
And
but now we have the Twitter mob, right?
Now we have all these crazy bastards online. We had one cartoon that was by cartoonist Sandy Huffaker in our group. It was a guy holding a book called The Quran for Dummies. This group CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations, put out this call to their membership, which was send emails to Daryl Cagle, who's the boss of this cartoonist, to get him to fire this evil cartoonist who denigrated the Quran. And I got like 10,000 crazy screaming emails.
You must have received some death threats at this point in your career, right?
That there were probably 200 that were explicit death threats.
Wow.
So you have a security detail now?
You know, I don't know that it's that crazy, but after the Charlie Hebdo murders, there has been a big chilling effect on cartoonists, organizations, and conventions, and very high security and security costs. I was a keynote speaker at the College Media Association convention in New York. It's what used to be the College Newspapers Association, but now it's media because so many of them.
Right.
We were scheduled to be there before the Charlie Hebdo murders, and when the murders happened, the NYPD asked them to have all this security, and they hired like 15 security guards, and they bought the metal detectors from the front doors, and the NYPD had a cordon around the building, and they had plainclothes police through the audience, and it cost them all these thousands of dollars that they didn't expect to spend. And you know, they don't pay their speakers, they're poor, their colleges. And that is a burden that's being thrown onto cartoonist meetings all over. I just had two conventions in France where it was just all surrounded by the SWAT team, and it's a burden that chills the profession. And it's a difficult burden to bear. We've also got the burden of these hacker attacks.
Right.
So also after Charlie Hebdo, a lot of prominent editorial cartoon sites and cartoonist organization sites have been suffering hacker attacks. And against our Kegel.com site, which is kind of...
Really? Against your site?
Yeah, the little Kegel.com site. If you go to Kegel.com, C-H-E-L-E.com, you can see that it's kind of what you would expect the world to see as the face of American editorial cartooning to the world. And we've gotten... The hacker attacks increased like 10,000-fold around the time of the Charlie Hebdo attacks. Actually, a little bit before, we had the site all full of Kim Jong-un on the front page. that was at the time of all the Sony attacks, and despots don't like cartoons of themselves, and so our attacks started in earnest just before the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and then after Charlie Hebdo, the other cartoonist organizations started getting the attacks. And, this is expensive stuff to deal with. You know, the site goes down every so often, and people are nice about it. They understand what's going on. And we did a crowdfunding thing, and that was very nice to help us cover the additional costs of dealing with all the hacker attacks. But, the scale of it is just fantastic. And these guys have strategies, and they
are... And you're in a unique position as well, right? Because you not only are you drawing these yourself, but you're curating them from other people, right?
Yeah.
What's the difference between those two? What are the roles like there? When you're curating, what does that entail?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do with my package that's different from the other packages is that I wanted to include cartoonists from around the world, and I try hard to get American newspapers to print cartoonists from around the world, and American editors are very resistant to that. But we have great cartoonists from around the world. You can see them in the package on kegelcartoons.com, and we have even more of them on kegel.com that we don't license out, but just who participate on the site. And it can be difficult for American audience to understand international cartoons, and difficult for an international audience to understand American cartoons. So we also have a lot of resistance in the international papers trying to get American cartoons into them.
Hmm.
And you can understand, you know, we draw donkeys and elephants, so why should someone in Pakistan know what we're talking about with donkeys and elephants?
Right.
But, you know, it's frustrating, too. The government of Pakistan blocks my Kegel.com site. And the government of Iran blocks Kegel.com.
Hmm.
You know, occasionally other governments will block it. Interestingly, the government, I'm told by some folks in Pakistan, that Pakistan started blocking the site when the cartoons were all about this crazy preacher, I guess, that was burning the Quran.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? Well, most of the cartoons were caricatures of this idiot with a burning Quran. There was nothing in favor of the guy. They were all bashing this guy.
Right, right.
But
you're depicting someone defacing the Quran.
Yeah, and that was too much for them, and that's when they blocked the site. So we've got something to offend everybody.
Yeah, good for
equal
you.
Equal opportunity offenders.
And you know what? Like embedded in our Constitution, and the freedom of the press and the freedom of speech is so integral to our society here. And I think that's completely lost on a lot of other society. Maybe not a lot of other societies, fewer and fewer. But I understand censorship for standards and practices, like right, like your kids are reading the newspaper and you don't want F-bombs all over the place. I understand that. We as a society have decided, like, you know what, you're not allowed to put that on network television or whatever. But as far as subject matter, I think it's great that the internet has allowed you to say whatever you want to say, and that you now are able to select content that is as inflammatory or not as you choose to be, rather than having to deal with as many editors. Hopefully the decentralization process has allowed you to be even more expressive, and your writers to be more expressive.
Well, I think that we're unique and lucky in America to have these press freedoms, and I think in most of the world, cartoonists don't have freedoms like anything like we do. We have a cartoonist that we represent from Slovakia. It's an EU country. They've got freedom of the press in their constitution. Freedom of the press is guaranteed in the EU countries. But still, the prime minister of Slovakia sued the cartoonist for insulting him. He had a bad back, and the cartoonist drew a cartoon of the prime minister in the doctor's office holding up his X-ray. And the doctor says, you can't have a bad back because you're spineless. And with that, he sued the cartoonist for 250,000 euros and went to the Slovakia Supreme Court. There was a similar case in the Czech Republic.
He didn't win that, did he?
He didn't win, but
okay.
He caused a bloody fortune.
Right. Of course.
And, despots all around the world use civil suits to chill cartoonists, where they claim to have a free press, but they abuse the civil suits. And that's true in all these countries, lots of countries where you would expect them really to have a free press, like EU countries, particularly in countries where they don't have a history of a free press, like in the Eastern European countries. And it's terrible, and it's a blight. And what we have here in America is Jerry Falwell versus Larry Flint, which allows us to do any just awful things about any public figure that we want, and public figures give up their rights to sue. Well, that's kind of uniquely American.
It really is. Don't have paparazzi or any, but that, yeah, it's not elsewhere.
Do you think that that's under threat?
Well, I think that's something that I would like to spread as an American value around the world, and I think we need to recognize that it doesn't exist around the world, and that press freedoms are important, and they're not as clear-cut as you'd like for them to be. You know, if not for that case law, editorial cartoonists could be suffering the civil lawsuit blight that other cartoonists have. I have a cartoonist friend in Algeria who tells me he's always got 20 civil suits at least against him from
that's horrendous.
It's terrible. So it's not all like the Syrian cartoonists who get tortured to death and get their hands broken, or the other ones who get thrown in jail. I mean, there's a blight of that, but that tends to happen in countries where you expect it to happen. And in the countries where you don't expect it to happen, it's the civil lawsuit blight, and that's terrible.
Daryl, I want to interject here with we've got, again, this is our first live stream video episode that we've done so far on Blurred Radio. So we're engaging, applause in the room. So we're engaging with an audience who are watching the live stream here for the first time as well. And we have a question coming in for you from a user named Maction asking, are there ways in which the more direct involvement of people such as Twitter has been beneficial to you?
Well, we have a bigger audience now on the web than we've had before. It's great to get response from people. You draw because you want people to see it and get your opinion out there and get a response from the world.
Sure. Have you seen an increase in your number of in the amount of engagement you get? You know, back in when everything was snail mail, as you were talking about, I would imagine you got letters of complaint and frustration and the opposite as well. So now with Twitter, do you hear more from? Are you active on Twitter? Are you?
I am.
Or do you choose to?
CAGLE. I'm at DKagle. to be frank, I used to be the cartoonist for MSNBC.com. And we had a nice partnership with them. Before that, I had a partnership with Slate. So we had a relationship with MSN for about 12, 13 years. And that was great. And we were beneficiary of a ton of traffic from MSN during all those years. And it gave us a good opportunity to see what the audience really likes. And frankly, what the audience wants from editorial cartoonists is celebrity schadenfreude. The most popular thing we ever had on the website was Janet Jackson's boob. And that was, there was a time with Janet Jackson's boob and with Kramer from Seinfeld's racist rant.
Right.
More traffic than actual MSNBC.com.
Oh, my God.
It was crazy. We had five servers in line, and we had, I think it was 68 million page views for Janet Jackson's boob.
Oh, my word.
Madness. But that we had the partnership with MSN. And so now what happened was MSNBC was sold to Comcast, and they fired everybody. And so I don't have that partnership anymore. So I've got more normal kind of real-world traffic. And
yeah.
That's it. So in fact, you say, is my audience increasing? No, I had this big collapse because I don't have that fire hose of traffic from MSN anymore, which was fun, but that's the old days. It's what journalism is turning into. My old editor from MSNBC, who I worked with all those years, now he's the editor for marijuana.com.
Wonderful.
Editor, the old guy that was in charge of MSNBC and MSN News, who actually hired me to come in partnership with Slate, he's now the president of cheeseburger.network.
And, you know, cheeseburger and marijuana, it's just...
And they go together.
Yeah.
Cheeseburger?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
No, that's a big site, and they get lots of traffic. They've got the Fail blog. They've got great stuff there, but that is what journalism in the 21st century is turning into. What can I say?
Do you have any thoughts on BuzzFeed?
Oh, man. You've opened Pandora's box, Dave.
It's what we do. Right. And I have more serious questions, too, for you as well. And we've only got a few minutes left, but I wanted to throw that out there since you brought up cheeseburger and the future of journalism in the 21st century.
I don't know. I stay in my tiny little editorial cartoon corner. Oh, I also syndicate 12 columnists. Because we just sell to editorial page editors. And we do some web stuff, but we don't have a lot of website clients. There's no culture of websites paying for content like the print people still do. So we still make our income from print, although we have some great web clients where our cartoons are on foxnews.com. We've got a nice bunch of clients on the web, but they are just minimal. It's really still all about the print clients who have a culture of paying their bills.
Interesting. Yeah, paying your bills. Mm-hmm. Not a millennial feature.
Right.
I see this thing come through my Facebook feed. It's an investment startup, and it says millennials have become the Ben Franklin generation. And I think we're more like the Amex generation, I feel like. You know, we all have credit card debt, and we all have student loan debt, and I know very few millennials who are actually like, would pay money for content, you know, unless it's
heading more that direction, that's for sure. Yeah,
hopefully.
Yeah.
I had an answer to that problem.
I think everyone's looking for it right now. I mean, that's kind of some of the what we talk about on Blurred Radio a lot is business models in media and how they're changing. I did want to ask you one more question before we take off, and it is a somewhat politically oriented question, not about policy per se, but I've heard it said, and I've read a few articles in New Republic and The Atlantic about why the left is so much better at satire in the 21st century. Most mainstream satire leans left, and conservatives have tried to launch satire sites and usually just fail miserably. And I'm curious whether you have any ideas about why that is. Because I see political cartoons as obviously as a type of satire. And I'm curious whether you see something endemic to the culture of left versus right that makes leftist satire stronger and more compelling.
Or it's certainly more present, like you said, in mainstream media. Yeah.
Say that one more time.
Conservatives are humorless.
They don't know how to laugh at themselves.
You notice that?
Yeah, just take a look at Fox News, right?
A lot of people.
Everything's a crisis.
A lot of people complain about editorial cartoonists being overwhelmingly liberal, and that's true. And we have an issue with that because most editors are conservative. But, you know, most newspapers are tiny little rural and suburban papers, and the liberal papers tend to be the big urban papers. And those are the papers that would hire an editorial cartoonist. So
interesting.
It makes sense that the cheap conservative editors don't hire the editorial cartoonist, and they don't see many conservative cartoonists. But on the other hand, the conservative cartoons get reprinted more because the conservative editors like to preach to the choir, and the liberal editors are the ones that'll print the column left, column right, and put in a diversity of views. So it's frustrating for the majority, the liberal majority of cartoonists who are reprinted less, and nice for the small minority of conservative cartoonists who are reprinted more. Also, it's an even smaller minority of conservative cartoonists who are funny. We've got funny ones in our package. One that I will plug here is Rick McKee for the Augusta Chronicle. He is just great and very funny. Another one, Nate
Rick
Wheeler,
McKee
doesn't like being called conservative, but I'd call him conservative from my perspective. He draws for the Columbus Dispatch, and he is just great and also very funny. Yeah, you know, they talk about how talk radio is dominated by conservatives, and actually, that is, I don't see that, because I see all this morning zoo kind of radio as being what the liberal radio consists of, and
largely, very true.
it's the angry preach to the choir, restate to everyone what they already know, so that that's reassuring
right.
them stuff that comes from the right that is not. The nature of what discourse is like on the left. On the left, you know, you look at that variety of views. You're those editors who print the left and the right column, and we like being challenged by new ideas and looking at different stuff. And conservatives like being reassured by hearing the things that they already know to be true.
And on that note, Daryl Cagle.
There it is.
Hey, man, thanks so much for joining us. Once again, I know there are two different websites, right? So what's the best way to get a hold of you, and where can people see your stuff?
Look at is Cagle.com, Cagle.com, and they should subscribe to our excellent daily cartoon newsletter, which is free. And when you don't like it, you just click to unsubscribe, and it's a lovely thing, and they should all just come and do that.
Awesome.
Wonderful.
Fantastic.
Thanks so much.
We'll be
man.
Posting this up. We'll shoot you a link when it's live, and we look forward to seeing people respond to our new video. So thank you very much for joining us, Daryl Cagle.
Hey, I really enjoy Blurred Radio. You guys are doing a great job, and I'm impressed with all the marketing stuff you guys talked about. So when you get some good marketing idea for me, give me a call.
I will.
Wonderful.
I will, absolutely.
We've got some great conversations coming up on that topic very shortly. So yeah, thanks so much, Daryl. Much appreciated.
Have a great Friday.
I'll talk to you soon.